And a couple more examples. The 1991 Summers Memo. Chief Economist of the World Bank, Larry Summers, said on paper, quote, "I always thought that underpopulated countries in Africa are vastly underpolluted." Unquote. Now, you might think this would have been the death knell for Larry Summers' career, or possibly he would have left the World Bank with his tail between his legs. Far from it. He's since worked as Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, President of Harvard University, Director of the White House National Economic Council. José Lutzenberger, Brazil's Secretary of the Environment at that time, replied, quote, "Your reasoning is perfectly logical, but totally insane. Your thoughts provide a concrete example of the unbelievable alienation, reductionist thinking, social ruthlessness, and the arrogant ignorance of many conventional economists concerning the nature of the world we live in."
Unquote.
I suspect that José Lutzenberger pretty much knew the score when he made that comment, "Your reasoning is perfectly logical, but totally insane," because just that conjunction, that you could be perfectly logical in the world of economics and still be insane in the real world, the idea that the world of economics is not the real world. To put that on paper, identified himself as somebody who was going to speak truth to power, and perhaps that's why he was pressured to quit the following month and never worked in politics again. And one final example, quoted by David Corton, about the minister responsible for Malaysia's forests. Apparently he explained that since money grows faster than trees, Malaysia will be better off once it's cut down all its trees and put the money in the bank to earn interest. And this is a graph by Loh and Goldfinger, 2006, and the summary is, humanity is living beyond its means. Well, with the obsession on money and corresponding concerted disregard of the real world, it's not a particularly surprising finding. So we turn to the private story.
Compared with the public story, remember all the good points about money as increasing people's ability to trade, differentiation, store of value, and so on, essential for prosperity. I think I would contrast that with the 19th century economist Frédéric Bastiat, and thank you to Lynn Gerry for drawing this quote to my attention. He said, quote, "When plunder becomes a way of life for a group of men in a society, over the course of time, they create for themselves a legal system that authorizes it and a moral code that glorifies it." Unquote. Well, if that was true in the 19th century, before we had such innovations as corporate personhood, how much more true is it in the 21st century? Is it surprising that the children whom I asked on how they could improve the world all seem to assume this would have to involve making their lives worse? Well, schools, mass media, religious institutions, companies, all the institutions which define our society, which use money, normalize selfishness, and they never ask real questions. I mean, if people don't know that money is debt, that there is effectively a kind of a ground rent on all the money in circulation, and whoever happens to be holding it at the time, somebody is paying interest on it to central bankers, people didn't notice that, then they're not going to be able to object to it. So much more subtle than the Danegelt, the gold that people paid to the Viking raiders, who threatened to plunder and burn the place down to the ground if they didn't get some tribute. The debt crisis, the financial crisis, these are still public touchstones. They're repeated endlessly through the commercially controlled media. So when people come out and say, look, I was an economic hitman, and you need to think about who benefits from third world countries getting into debt, this is basically just a more subtle replacement for direct colonial rule by force. These countries have been given a flag to wave, they've nominally got their own currency, and many of them are even pegged to the dollar anyway. Then you've got to take that on board. But no, if you've been schooled in the public's story of money, then this seems fairly far-fetched. So, to summarize, money, I think, is not a medium of exchange, as much as a medium of extracting tribute. Remember, if you've got self-sufficient community in Africa, maybe they have a gift economy, and this is how traditional communities tended to work, then how do you control these people? If they have the solidarity, the cohesiveness, then this is a threat. These people are a large, organized force. If you could somehow turn them against one another, then they're easier to control. And if they're using your imperial tokens, then, because of the way that banks work, you get to charge them ground rent on this. So you have this story which glorifies and legalizes going in there and saying, you guys are poor. We know what it takes to not make you poor. You need to monetize things. You need to boost your earnings. Is money, in fact, a safe store of value? I think absolutely not. I think it's an unsafe store of value because the central banks can inflate it according to how they wish. And this is exactly what they're doing. The national currencies are being inflated in concert. And that explains, to a certain extent, why people are getting interested in something like Bitcoin, which is working as a currency, but doesn't have a central bank in charge. Is money, in fact, a measure of productivity? How does this explain Africa? Is it just a continent full of lazy people? I would say no. The private story is a measure of complicity with plutocracy. So, complicity with plutocracy because, yes, you have the fiat fat cats at the very top, then you have the entourage, and nearer the bottom, you have working class people, and then nearer the bottom still, in a global sense, you have most everybody in Africa, a few complicit rich leaders excepted. Africa is the continent with the greatest economic inequality. So, it's a measurement of who you work for. Money, as I think doesn't need further explaining, is intimately connected to the political and legal systems, although it's never taught that way. Money arose as a tool of empire for raising armies and extracting tribute, and my claim, given what we've seen about who controls the money system, how they seem to have no compunction about the suffering of its users, the environment, or anybody else, or anything, is money, far from being essential for prosperity and survival, is actually a threat to prosperity, human survival, and the survival of a lot of other species. So that, I'm claiming, is something of a reversal of the public story, but I'm also claiming that the mendacity of this story is rapidly becoming public. People are working out what's going on. They're never told that somebody's gaining for all these losses that are occurring in the financial system, but they're working this out themselves. So that concludes the first part, Why Money Will End, and now we're going to hear part two, Preparing for the End of Money. Well, I'm going to start with some 21st century truths that business as usual is an increasingly non-viable option. That is my claim, but certainly many people still count on money in the bank. It's a reflection of the fact that money underpins and controls the key social institutions. Now, social institutions have a sort of survival imperative. They try to perpetuate themselves, and for all these institutions that rely on money for coordination and organization, that means they've got to keep money working in the way it's working now. So there's a huge effort to normalize the status quo. Yes, there's people starving in Africa, but don't worry. We've got some guys on the GM boat. They're sorting it out. It'll all come good in the end. So whatever happens, don't think that the money system might possibly change. The question is never raised. How is this possible? Well, John Taylor Gatto has been instrumental for me in understanding the massive dumbing down by mass compulsion schooling. And this, of course, wasn't, in America at least, kicked off by government. This was an institution begun by the rich industrialists. They made factories. They wanted people to be sufficiently narrowed in perspective that they volunteered for working in these factories, and mass compulsion schooling was the instrument they chose to do this. Obedience and loyalty to money is trumpeted over other values.
Now, the same dynamic which resulted in people being dumbed down has led to the rise of agribusiness and the monoculture to try to subjugate the land and control that, which in the longer term obviously has serious implications for the rest of life, especially people who are eating from that land. In the short term, is this a problem? No. Could be a good opportunity for those seeking to profit from the scarcity and the world food markets, because hungry people are going to pay more for food than people who are not.
Scarcity is something that falls out naturally from this system. So news this month, the Monsanto Protection Act effectively bars federal courts from being able to halt the sale or planting of GMO seeds, no matter what health issues may arise concerning GMOs in the future. So Monsanto, feeling very confident about their control of the legal system, says, well, let's tie the hands of the lawmakers on paper. Let's get this down in black and white that they're not allowed to make any laws that would impinge on our profits. It's confirmation of the extent to which big business thinks it's calling the shots, how government is effectively just one more natural monopoly that, in practice, doesn't have anything to do with the will of the people. Another story this month, I'm quoting peer executive director Jeff Rutsch. I think that's Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. The EPA, that's the Environmental Protection Agency, relaxes the permissible radioactive release guidelines. Jeff Rutsch said, quote, no compelling justification is offered for increasing the cancer deaths of Americans innocently exposed to corporate miscalculations several hundredfold, unquote. News this week, all 104 nuclear reactors currently operational in the US have irreparable safety issues and should be taken out of commission and replaced, former chairman of the US Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Gregory B. Jatko, said. Former chairman of the US Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Not a man whose views are easy to dismiss, and he doesn't mince his words. Do you think those nuclear reactors are going to be taken out of commission and replaced? Another story this week, operators of the Fukushima Daiichi power plant, Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, indicated that they were, quote, losing faith, unquote, in temporary storage pits for the radioactive water, but didn't have anywhere else to put it. On Saturday, as much as 120 tons of contaminated water seeped from an underground tank. A new leak was spotted on Sunday. And a third story, analysis of commercially available rice imported into the US has revealed it contains levels of lead far higher than regulations suggest are safe. Some samples exceeded the provisional total tolerable intake set by the US Food and Drug Administration by a factor of 120. So, 3 points there about the ongoing worldwide food crisis. Does the food crisis affect the poor more than the rich? Yes, of course it does. I think it's about 1 billion hungry people, people increasingly skipping meals, even having foodless days in so-called poor countries. Is the worldwide food crisis limited to the poor? Obviously not. It's not actually primarily just about quantity, but it's also quality. Worldwide, this system, governments, rules, regulations, trade, which claims that your welfare, citizens' welfare, is at its heart. Perhaps it was, or perhaps it wasn't, but it certainly doesn't appear to be the case now. It appears now to be a comfort blanket, something that you can wrap around yourself and think, well, there's somebody called the Environmental Protection Agency. That sounds good, doesn't it? And if your subconscious says don't go there because you haven't got the energy to deal with it, then you'll think that they're protecting the environment. You'll think that the Food and Drug Administration has your best interests at heart. And that isn't going to make a heap of difference if you come down with some poisoning because of tainted food. Food is just one of the innumerable converging crises, whether it's lack of soil, fossil fuels, metals, ozone, biodiversity, polar ice, new diseases, biomass, freshwater, sea level, climate, superbugs, pollution, or whatever else, the powers that be, as we heard in Unwelcome Guests episode 630, seem basically to be uninterested in slowing down the planet's sixth mass extinction.
And what is perhaps the fastest engine of planetary destruction right now? the ideologically motivated claim that the American way of life is non-negotiable, and the determination to use all means necessary to perpetuate it for as long as possible.
Well, remember the U.S. declared policy of full-spectrum dominance. The U.S. is now routinely using military hardware within the U.S., and in 2013, I think it was last month, the U.S. Air Force stopped publishing drone statistics. I think it was March, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security increased its order for bullets. They're buying 1.6 billion bullets. That's 5 bullets for every man, woman, and child in the U.S., including hollow-point bullets, which are illegal to use in combat, but good for urban environments because they take a hole out of the person, not whatever's behind them. So, is martial law ahead in the U.S., or even a mass kill-off? I don't see what they're planning to do with 1.6 billion bullets. People have said, well, that's because they're trying to price ordinary people out of the market. They can't prohibit people from buying guns and bullets because legal restriction and public sentiment, so they're just going to buy up all the bullets, stop people in that way. Either way, the point is, business as usual, looking increasingly sticky, especially for the US, with rapidly increasing disparity in rich and poor, more and more hunger, more and more environmental damage, potential social collapse. People aren't being fed because, hey, it's more profitable that way. According to this very narrow criterion of profitability, war and violent death make a lot of money. So, in a financial sense, they may be profiting people. And that's, don't get me started on race-specific bioweapons and a lot of the grey goo. And people in China saying these new H1N1 variants are actually been deliberately engineered by drug companies. I don't know. But unless we change business as usual, we can see more resource wars, more ecocide, more mass extinction. What's the alternative? Well, hierarchies, and the people at the top of the hierarchies in particular, would like you to think that there is no alternative. Humanity might just be reaching the end of the road. I claim, no, this need not be the end of the road. The existing structures do have to go. If you want to be a butterfly, you can't be a caterpillar all your life. I think this is certainly a confusing time, an unsettling time, possibly a time of great anxiety. Doesn't mean it has to be a hopeless time. Doesn't mean it can't be a joyous time as well. I think we should be looking for alternative ideologies. And I claim that as long as we use money, we will not find alternative ideologies. And yes, that includes Bitcoin, if you're a Bitcoin fan. I think that's a step in the right direction, but only one step. I suggest, as Charles Eisenstein does, we need to look at reconnecting to one another, an age of reunion. And I'm going to quote from Buckminster Fuller, polymath, inventor of the geodesic dome, good egg and 20th century visionary, as I've described him here. He said, quote, "I'm not trying to counsel any of you to do anything really special except dare to think and dare to go with the truth and dare to really love completely," unquote. So, my exhortation to think about the status quo, as Derek Jensen pointed out, does it really matter that most people spend large parts of their lives doing things that they are not personally interested in? I think it has to matter. I think it's an absolute sham. I think it's a tyranny. Does it have to be that way? Do we ever have that conversation? Does it get much further than, I'm really tired of that company. That boss does my head in. Well, darling, you need the money. Turn the telly on. Crack a beer. As a society, we need to say, what kind of insanity is this? Next thought. Does money discourage greed? Or does it encourage it? Because it's amazing how many people say, if I ask them to imagine a moneyless society, well, that will never work because people are greedy. It's almost as if it's a Stockholm syndrome. They project their current anxiety onto a future system. They know that people are greedy in this system, and the system claims to prevent people from being greedy. A little bit of reflection will reveal that that's a pretty hollow claim, and yet it's almost like a knee-jerk reaction. So, some thoughts about human nature. Is it important to have a way to force people to do things they don't want to do. As a rich middle-class American once described money to me, and I had to ask him whether that applied to him, and obviously it didn't apply to him. He didn't want people to have a way to force him to do things he didn't want to do. And, yeah, money is only a part of it. In America, just using money doesn't force people in other countries to do things you want them to do. So the military comes in as a large part of this, but the ideology is there, that there are virtuous people who deserve to make the decisions for other people. Next thought. Are people actually naturally lazy? Or could laziness, as Charles Eisenstein suggested recently, be a reaction to be doing those things they're not personally interested in? I would encourage you, if you're thinking about how to prepare for a world beyond money, to think about your calling. Speak to your heart and ask yourself which wise and kind-hearted people should I be working together with? Because why would you want to work for anybody who's not wise and kind-hearted? And people don't typically reject a job based on the character of the boss. And when there's things like banks determined to repossess your property unless you give them these magic beans, you can understand people's attention to the beans. So, in a post-money world, think about what should we be doing and what can I contribute? The focus, if you take a paid job, is on what the boss says you have to do. It's not on you. It's not on what is within you. I'm speaking predominantly to the young and the young at heart, people who never gave up hope that they can make a real contribution to the world. And I'm going to ask, how much do we actually need, both to survive and to thrive, meaning to be of best use to others? A very down-to-earth one, how much of our own food do we grow? And do we depend on money for water, food, energy, heat, or transport? And the most important word of the lot here is we, because you may have a wonderful urban farm, producing your own food, living off-grid, and if you're surrounded by millions of hungry neighbours used to eating off the agribusiness model, then as fossil fuel becomes increasingly scarce and the trucks stop coming, you're going to be surrounded by a lot of hungry people, in which case, good luck. I'm not even going to go down the barbed wire and guns route. That has never appealed to me. So think about we. So if you live in a city, we means a lot of people. It's a lot of manpower, a lot of creative talent and energy and ideas, but it's going to take some organizing. It's not necessarily going to be easy to generate enough food, get enough clean water, as the existing centralized hierarchical structures, massively inefficient structures, it has to be said, we'll get on to that, but in the transition period, these are the key elements: water, food, energy, heat, transport. So in practical terms then, if you're a carpenter, get some saws laid in. If you're a computer programmer, have you got spare computer? Have you got fallback equipment? Are you relying on centrally given power? So stocking up on surplus, it's inefficient according to your just-in-time business model. You might say, well, these computers, they get cheaper every year. I'm not going to buy a spare one now. But this system isn't going to carry on forever. I mean, here in Bangladesh, a lot of people have a 30-kilo bag of rice in the kitchen because you never know when you might really want some food around. And yeah, a lot of people couldn't afford that. If you're in the position where it's easy for you to stock up now on spare stuff, then I think that's going to be a good idea. Not only for what you need to survive as an individual human being, but what you need to be productive, to be a member of a community. If you're a gardener, get some gardening tools. It might be a very small investment. And wouldn't it be irritating if, because supermarkets shut down, there's things that you can't get? In Bangladesh, it's not a shock if there's a brownout. We have about half a dozen every day, and we're used to these types of disruptions. But in the so-called developed world, the system is not prepared for these types of shocks and disruptions. And people also, psychologically, are not prepared. The next section is on window of opportunity, because we do have certain opportunities available to us now. Listening to my voice from the other side of the world is one. Remember Derek Jensen's point that people will fight to the death to preserve what they think their life depends on. If you're actually incapable of growing food, then whether there's a supermarket with food in it, it's a life or death issue. It's therefore going to be difficult for you to contemplate alternatives to it. Is it even going to be legal for you in a developed country to dig a tube well? I don't know. But they're all over Bangladesh, and I don't think anybody has any licenses for them. I think they just dig them. Now, yeah, there's problems in terms of groundwater and stuff, but if you're in a city, how long are you planning to survive if the centralized water system goes down? Remembering a friend of mine from senior management of a private water company in the UK said they had a meeting about this bird flu. The topic was, what are we going to do if bird flu kicks off and employees don't come into work? And the best they could come up with was, we're going to pray that it doesn't happen, because they didn't have a way of continuing to provide water to people. Things could go from bad to very bad very quickly because of the interlocking nature of these systems. If you can get some redundancy in supply, you can dig a tube well or any kind of well. I mean, it's expected you won't be using it now, but look into alternative systems for food, water, energy, and don't do so just for yourself, but spread the word. There's a lot of people very dissatisfied with what's going on. Now, I'm not going to recommend spending a lot of time on protests. It might have a good effect. It could release some tension. You could meet some other people who are like-minded. Don't do it because you're going to impress the people in power. The main purpose of these demonstrations, as far as they're concerned, is to use up people's time and energy. I would suggest instead getting going with productive alternatives. Probably not in the economic sense, but in the real-world sense. Learning how to grow food, creating abundance, meeting like-minded people, doing your own projects. We do still have quite a degree of freedom. We have a window of opportunity. The centralized systems, by and large, are still working, and they do offer some remarkable possibilities. I mean, Wikipedia is an incredible resource. So whatever parts are of most interest to you, fairly easy matter to download it. We might not have the internet forever. Go to reprap.org. Three-dimensional printers. So it's like a 2D printer. 2D printer, you give it an image of a document and put ink on the paper according to the image. It creates a copy of that image. 3D printer doesn't have an ink jet and squirt ink. It has an extruder and it melts plastic and lets it cool down to make a 3D object. So what would be the first thing you would print if you had a 3D printer? Well, if you think about it for a while, perhaps the best first thing to make would be a spare printer in case the first printer goes down. That's exactly the aim of the RepRap project. They haven't yet got an ability to print semiconductors and chips, so you have to buy those parts separately, but it can make most of itself. And what does big business have to say about this? It's trying to shut it down using copyright law, because it's an order of magnitude cheaper, so much more efficient, that it wipes out a lot of possibilities for making money under the current system. Normally, you need to buy something plastic. You're going to have to buy that in a shop where it's been shipped from a bunch of other places, from a factory somewhere. It's been made in huge numbers. So you can cut out all the middlemen, you don't need the big factory. When you need the object, you just download the file, print it. So it's like having an industrial process plugged into your computer. You get the objects when you need them. And if something breaks, you've got the pattern for it. You could put the broken bits of plastic into a hopper, melt them down, and make yourself a new one. So plastic objects cease to be this horrible disposable thing, becomes much more recyclable. This technology is still in its infancy, hasn't received any organized backing from the old world, which recognizes it instantly as a part of the new world,
being worked on horizontally by volunteers trying to promote tools to create abundance.
So not what the existing powers that be, economically, not what they want. So that's a window of opportunity. I've never owned a 3D printer, but they are looking increasingly attractive. It may well be that there's some very productive crops that just didn't suit the business model, which you could buy seeds from over the internet, and get it delivered, look into it. Or it might be medicines. There's a bunch of herbs. Although they've been the mainstay of human medicine for most of human history, they're now called alternative because they don't come out of a factory. Which is going to be the most useful one in a post-money world? Are people still going to be organized in factories and industrial processes? Well, maybe. It's not certain. That's a few windows of opportunity to create abundance, to use the options that we have now that our forefathers never had. Does this mean to say that it'll be gone for our children? We're going to be talking about the time when we had computers? I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe they'll just continue to get cheaper, more abundant. But promoting abundance, and that would be another way to label it, promoting abundance seems to me to be a good way to prevent things from getting difficult. What about the deeper meanings here?
Well, earlier I said that money disconnects its users from one another and from the consequences of their actions on the real world.
I suggest that when we quit money, whether it's suddenly overnight, whether it's over a period of years, then a lot of the benefit of doing that will be to reverse this process. We will be reconnecting with the real world instead of the money world. We won't think about, does it make money? We will think about the richer, the broader, and ultimately
the more important consequences in the real world. Does it promote abundance? Is it harmful or helpful to life? And just as use of money promoted monoculture by dampening down people's consciences, people's sense of right and wrong, their local values, then when people give up money, this may reawaken a diversity, an openness to the local environment, to what's within each one of us. We shall come alive, recalling how liberated Swelo felt when he walked away from his money. What would happen to the world if everybody was alive to that feeling of security, that feeling that no more rent would ever have to be paid? There would be no more bills.
If you're free from fear, if you're operating out of love, then you're in flow. This is an experience, I think we all know it. How many mothers nursing their own kid ever stop to think, am I doing the right thing? How many of them were thinking about money, about anything to do with a numerical world? I think, no, you have a tremendous creativity and energy when you're doing what you should be doing, when you're working out of love, when you're giving. I contrast that with fear as a motivator. And I think pretty much everybody who's working for money knows what I'm talking about. The stress of, am I going to please the boss? The inertia. The boss said to do it this way. If I do it that way, is it going to be okay? The paralysis as a result. I think it's a much less efficient way for creative tasks, where you have to use your brain, then trying to control people through fear really is an inferior way of doing it. I'm looking ahead to the world I want to live in. It's a world of love, a world of people being creative, generous, when we're playing, not working. People of my generation have grown up in this world where adults have said, oh, you're going to have to learn about the real world. You're going to have to learn about business, working with colleagues, not with friends. What you do is going to be planned, it's going to be a routine, probably going to be quite boring. It's not going to be the spontaneous, unpredictable, fun things that you have in the social world. You're going to have contracts, and they're going to be enforceable. We've got this hidden power. We've got the money organization power and the backup of law, the backup of police, and it's going to be tied down. It's going to be predictable. Well, that's not the world that I see ahead. I see a world of shriveling institutions because they were never efficient in the human sense anyway. I see a world of flexible agreements between people, a gift economy, a world in which individuals feel much more free to behave as they want to behave, not as the system wants them to behave. Now, this might not seem to square with what I said before about the US Department of Homeland Security stocking up with billions of bullets. Whose security are they ensuring? Well, I think they're stocking up on bullets because this is the answer of those coercive systems. People are going to be forced through bullets. When the money system breaks down, they're going to know these are the rules and this is what you do. The gloves come off. And you don't wage a war on the arms industry. What do you do? You notice that their whole premise is fraudulent. They're stocking up on bullets because they're friends with the arms manufacturers. Are people really going to be shooting at other people? Well, there's only so many of your kith and kin you can kill in cold blood and feel good about life, even if you're a psychopath, because the thought occurs that you might be the next one to get a bullet. What am I saying here? Well, I'll give you a quote from Buckminster Fuller again. Quote,
"We are at the point where the integrity of the individual counts and not what the political leadership or the religious leadership says to do."
Unquote. He is suggesting that in the future, individual integrity will count more than these leaders. I think their power is waning. So maybe that's why they're stocking up on bullets, because that is the limit of their imagination, controlling people through fear. I think a lot of eyes are going to be on America. A lot of people still look at the US as being the most developed. So while I hope things don't go down the wrong road in the US, I think they might have to in some places at least, perhaps just as far as people involved in the next false flag coming out and blowing the whistle on it before it's even happened. Something to shock the world, that could happen here. How did that come about? The integrity of the individual regaining its position over the coercive institutions which, because they're so inefficient, are losing out in the lower energy world that we're now in. Deeper meanings of discounting the future. How could you, if you're an economist, justify cutting down the rainforest, say, for a big gain now, as opposed to harvesting them sustainably? When you add it up, no amount could be big enough in the present to counterbalance an infinite gain off into the future. Well, in economics you can, because you discount the future. You say a dollar tomorrow is worth less than a dollar today, so if that income stretches out into eternity, then after a few years it's not going to be worth much anyway in modern money. So when we discount the future in a mathematical sense, we are actually discounting for future generations. We are justifying stealing from our children, stealing the experience of living in a world covered in old-growth forests. That's exactly the reverse of what we need to be doing. We had better be not stealing from our children, but giving to them. We'd better be spending our lives trying to make things better in the longer term. And of course, there's nothing that says improving the world has to be a painful thing. It has to involve personal loss. If you don't express it in money terms, you can see it in quite the other way. I am the world. I am part of the world. Increasing the welfare of the world increases my welfare. So we definitely need to reconceive development. Think about these so-called developed countries, which tend to not make a lot of their own food. Well, why would they bother? They're developed. They can buy it on the world market. They can tend to not make a lot of their own stuff in general. America, for example, yeah, very effective at producing weapons, not very effective at producing other things. Tends to use the weapons in conjunction with currency to get the rest of the world to do its bidding. So, guiltlessness, parasitic lifestyle, superficial charm, selfishness and lying? Do we see a connection there with the characteristics of the developed countries? What about that great promoter of peace, the United Nations, and the Security Council? The single most important organization, at least as far as any kind of military action is concerned. Who are the permanent members? Would they in fact be the greatest arms-producing countries of the world? Do we see some kind of problem there? So, where is the real security? Well, I'm quoting from the Bible that says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven." What does that mean in practice? Well, any amount of wealth, if it's in a bank, is under the bank's control. Any amount of share certificates, stocks, bonds, bits of paper, whatever you want to write on them, are only valuable if other people acknowledge them as valuable. And at the moment, that means that the system, banks, law courts, and so on, acknowledge them as valuable. And if they decide they don't want to acknowledge your bits of paper as valuable, then they won't. They'll just designate you as a terrorist or something else and say, "Well, tough, that doesn't mean anything, and we've confiscated it." Does that mean you should insist on delivery of gold to your door rather than bits of paper? Well, I suppose that's a better bet. But then, are you trusting in gold? That's storing up for yourself treasures on earth. Now, what earthly use is gold, actually? And if you're a dentist, you might say, "Well, I want this to make fillings with." Fair enough. That's not why most people have got gold. So, what's this talking about storing up for yourself treasures in heaven? Whether you believe in heaven or not, it's not the type of thing you can easily send treasures to. I understand that to mean relationships. Because whatever the government says, my friends know who I am, and they know how I've treated them, whether I've trusted them, whether I've sincerely tried to help them. Now, no man is an island, and we all do depend on other people. I can't think of other people whom I would rather depend on than my friends, the people that I love the most. The money system says you don't need friends, you don't need relationships. You need credits, you need PhD certificates, or whatever else it is, and we, the system, the powers that be, we are the ones who decide and we issue it to you if you play by the rules. Well, we know where that has got us. That's what this presentation has been about. And I, for one, want to live in another world, not a world in which everybody is alone and fighting one another in order to try and claw their way up this hierarchy, but a world in which people are freely inspired to give out of love to one another. That, for me, is what it means to store up for yourself treasures in heaven. Looking at relationships, how you can help other people. Focus on altruism, sharing, cooperation. It doesn't become a deprival. It doesn't mean that your welfare goes down when other people's welfare goes up, but quite the converse. If you've lived in a real family, I think more or less by definition, then you have experienced what this is about. This is not pie in the sky. This is something that's probably well known to almost all of us, but it's not something that is generally seen as how society in the larger sense works. Why not? I'm suggesting that money, the zero sum, the whole story of competition for scarce resources is probably the main single factor for why people think this joyful, altruistic ethos could not prevail on a larger scale. And many people do think that. Their life experience seems to contradict it. And I'm not going to argue that, but I'm suggesting that a different way is possible. This really deserves a whole presentation in itself, but I think a piece of software is actually going to be more important than a presentation. I've made a lot of presentations about altruistic economics, but I've just got one slide on this one. How about a value system which was not one-dimensional, which didn't try and map all the complexities of the world just based on a system of numbers? A system in which, if there's three parties in a transaction, would allow three separate opinions to be registered. System which was not zero sum. So it would allow, if two parties interacted in a way that left them feeling both happy, it would allow for that to be expressed. Money system, remember, says one has to be positive, one has to be negative. If there's no money that changes happens, well, it's nothing to do with us. Money system counts that as a zero. That's the phenomenon which allows it to dismiss people who are living according to any other values, say a potlatch, a gift economy, where they meet each other's needs without money, to say, well, these people are poor, they're non-existent in the money terms, therefore we need to help them by bringing them into our system. What about a system which encouraged satisficing as opposed to maximizing, which didn't assume that people always want more stuff, but said people want enough? That means you could have a state in which everybody has enough, a state of abundance. So if you're an economist, this is an unthinkable possibility. And what about a system which normalized altruism? We heard before some of the different ways in which money seems to suggest it's a normal, even a healthy thing to be selfish, and no, you don't need to feel bad about it. If you have a kind of a legacy human nature that suggests perhaps selfishness is not the way, then get over it. Selfishness is the way. If you had a system instead which said, no, altruism is the way, and you should be able to feel good about the things you're doing. If your heart pulls you in another way, then go with it. Follow your passion. It seems to me, if you want to think of our bodies, our natural makeup as a kind of a hardware, that may have evolved over long periods of time. That isn't going to change from one day to the next. But that software, the program, the ideas, are liable to change very quickly. I think, for example, of the day on which Lady Diana died. Then people were suddenly able to talk to strangers. They'd shared a common experience of shock, and there was a joy, a readiness to engage in the amazement that celebrities could suddenly disappear like that. Now, that's just the first example that sprang to my mind of how things can suddenly change. So that's a thumbnail sketch of what I was trying to create in 2004, basically a mathematically formulated, justified system which had the potential to reorganize how we did things and who did what for whom. I still think it's got a lot of potential. It hasn't yet been put into software. That might take a wiser head than mine when it came to programming. But if you're interested in looking into that, then I'd encourage you to get in touch. You can email me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. Now, how to prepare for the end of money? How do we actually get ready for this? I mean, I hope it isn't going to suddenly collapse from one day to the next. If it happened that people gradually started to use money less and less, and over a period of a few years, then that would be a preferable situation, I think. I would suggest that the main thrust of any preparation should be to eliminate money from your life. I mean, your, in the plural sense. It's not enough to eliminate money from your life if you're surrounded by money users. We need to learn to take a broader responsibility for one another, those in our community. We need to unlearn all those things that we've learnt from using money. So, reducing money, one step, it disempowers us as it encourages us to depend on this amorphous system, particularly dangerous as we think the system may not have our best interests at heart. And reduce use of power over. What do I mean by that? Money has this hierarchical relationship, the payer and the payee. The boss is the guy who makes the decisions. We, I suggest, should try not to emulate that. We should try and be more horizontal in our organization. And practically, what to consume less of? Well, certainly television and newspapers, other such things which will put us to sleep and stop us from being alert to the changes which are ongoing. Certainly try and deal as little as possible with hierarchies, officials, governments, permits, etc. These are part of the old world which is passing away. try not to make judgments based on money. If people come, want your help on a good idea, don't ask, how much are you going to pay me? Try as much as you can to think, well, that's a good idea, I want to work on that. And conversely, people come with loads of money and a bad idea, try not to be greedy and work on it and do something that is somehow against your better judgment. So try not to make any judgments on money. Don't talk about money. Don't think about money as much as you can. Try and avoid linguistic metaphors that echo money. Don't talk about, yes, I'll buy that, when you mean you believe somebody. I'm quite serious that removing money from your mental habits, thinking less about money, is good preparation for a world when there is no money. Try not to buy things and sell things. If you've got things to give away, give them away. Live in the gift, see what happens. Now you might say, well, I can't just give away my product to strangers, then I'm going to have to sell it. Well, perhaps you shouldn't be giving things away to strangers. Perhaps giving things away to people you know. And you might say, oh, well, they don't need the thing. I had this the other week when I had something to give to people which they didn't need. I had to actually tell them, well, if there's somebody that you know who needs it, you could pass it on. And maybe you don't know anybody, but you could stream it out to them. Give it to them and they could pass it on and so on. It's a simple thing. But because we're so focused on individual personal property, it does take some thinking about. We need to get out of this proprietary mentality, this ownership, and cut down on long supply chains. If you're buying something and it comes from the other side of the world, what chance is there that that's still going to be working when the money system stops working? So find alternative suppliers. Cut down on processed food. Same deal. I mean, it's unhealthy to boot. But yeah, to come back to this idea about food and the land. So promote cooperation. Share your opinions. You're welcome to share this audio, of course. If you'd like to download it, it's available from unwelcomeguests.net/649. So nurture everything around you that's alive. Nurture love, independence, abundance. Avoid thinking that, oh, it's going to be a terrible time. It's something of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I would encourage you to have a positive view of the changes ahead, because the vision is very important. This is a quote from 17th century political activist and religious reformer, Christian communist Gerard Winstanley, and he wrote, quote, "When this universal law of equity rises up in every man and woman, then none shall lay claim to any creature and say, this is mine, and that is yours. This is my work, that is yours. But everyone shall put their hands to till the earth and bring up cattle, and the blessing of the earth shall be common to all. When a man hath need of any corn or cattle, take from the next storehouse he meets with. There shall be no buying and selling, no fairs or markets, but the whole earth shall be the common treasury for every man, for the earth is the Lord's." So, definitely get to know your neighbours. That's one for me. I don't even know the names of everybody who lives on the floor of the flat I live in. There's only three other doors. Definitely organize together to grow local food. Now, okay, that's easier for me perhaps because I live in Bangladesh, which has the best soil in the world and doesn't have any authorities or bureaucracies telling people they can't grow food. The country is just far too sensible for that and people wouldn't wear it. But even in the developed countries, you can organize. You can do guerrilla gardening. Think about what we heard in episode 598, Incredible Edible. Food is a really important thing that we need to move away from the industrial agriculture model, which consumes 10 calories of fossil fuel for every calorie produced. We need to move towards the food forest model, which is very low input of energy. You basically just plant the tree. Now, you might do a little bit of maintenance. What do you have in return? decades sometimes, or even hundreds of years, of productive fruit. Fresh, healthy, locally grown food, no long supply chains, no chemicals needed. It's amazing what nature can do, but the best time to plant a fruit tree is 10 years ago. So the sooner we get started on this, the better. And maybe now there's a few local ordinances. I was in Seoul a couple of years ago and I walked around and there wasn't a single fruit tree on public property. There was obviously some policy saying you do not plant fruit trees on public land. Well, if you're a guerrilla grafter, you can just graft a few productive branches on. I would encourage you to have a bigger scope, to just get down, plant saplings, fruit trees, everywhere you can, because I think that is going to be a better investment in the uncertain times ahead than anything involving paper or gold or stocks and bonds. So organizing together to grow local food, creatively avoiding the regulations, centralized systems, however you can manage it. My vision of the future features a rent strike in a village with a particularly healthy, strong community, somewhere like Catalan Spain maybe, and a large number of people saying en masse, we are part of the new world and we do not pay rent. We do not pay mortgages, we live where we live. And if they can achieve a critical mass in one village, one area, that can spread quickly to the whole country. And if it can spread in one country, it could quickly become global. So I foresee a worldwide rent strike breaking out quite quickly, and coupled with that, boost in growing local food. With a lot of local food available, nobody needing money to avoid the goon squad coming to kick them out of the house, then people's relationship to money is likely to change en masse. People will still go and do office work. They won't do so full of this endemic existential angst that bad things will happen to people without money. They'll know that they're in a world of abundance. There will be place to stay. There will be local food, water, perhaps some energy systems as well. Solar power, wind generation. Another quote from Gerard Wynne Stanley. We shall endeavour by our righteous acting not to leave the earth any longer entangled unto our children by self-seeking proprietors, but to leave it a free storehouse and common treasury to all, without respect of persons. And this we count is our duty, to endeavour to the uttermost. And if you think Gerard Wynne Stanley is a bit too 17th century and dusty old agrarian reformer style for you, this is a 6-year-old from YouTube with her idea about what she would like to do in the future.
When I grow up, I'm going to build a community that, well, it's not a community. I'm like going to have my own hotel. I'm going to have people there. And I'm going to invite them in. They don't have to pay to do it. It's like they can come into arms when they need it. We give them whatever they need. We even make their clean beds. We give them food, yummy food that, well, they tell us what they want and then we make it. But we don't want to pay for it. The people can offer, like, say, since you've been so sweet, like when I need arms around me, you can come and hug me and say, are you okay, and help me, here's a gift of money for you. But we don't say you gotta pay us. We say you don't have to pay us, just if you want to, since we've been so sweet to you, you can. I don't want to be out of my head. I want to be out of here, here connected down to my toes.
You've been listening to a special edition of Unwelcome Guests. Like all the others, it's available for download from our website, unwelcomeguests.net. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Which will come down.